Well then, after some 5 years of WDAF's conversation, and one in which many illustrious guests have been here, Vice President Johnson and many others of high rank, and many others famous in the sciences and the arts, I've always found my children relatively unimpressed. I'm happy to say that just on the promise of today's program, I have become a hero to my children. And that is that today our guest is Dr. Wernher von Braun. And he, of course, is, well, I hardly have to tell you, but if you want an official title, he directs the Marshall Space Flight Center. And that is the center that's in charge of developing NASA's large launch vehicles and doing related research, including the Saturn space vehicles being developed for a manned moonshot. And it is located, the center, at the famous Redstone Arsenal, which is in the northern part of Alabama. And so, I don't feel we have any trouble holding you while we pause for our first quick station break and then begin today's conversation. Dr. von Braun, today was an occasion that wasn't too unusual, I imagine, in your life, that of receiving an honorary degree, but on the occasion on which we're taping this, you have come not long ago from William Jewell College. What sort of degree was bestowed on you today, now?
A law degree.
A law degree.
Mm-hmm.
And a doctor of laws.
Yes, doctor of laws.
How many times are you a doctor of laws, I wonder, by now, or have you been
I
before?
Have one other from the University of Chattanooga. The others are science degrees.
I wanted to ask you, because I had never had the opportunity really to talk to anyone who had collected an honorary degree, much less several, but do you know how they make the selection of which degree they give you, of the honorary doctor of letters?
I was wondering that, too. Why
because,
laws?
Yes.
Or why?
Well, I've been wondering about this myself, because all I had to do with the law so far was stretching it in order to get the job done.
Maybe they thought you did a pretty good job.
Well, you have to know the law to know how to get around it,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are times, I imagine, when you have felt that getting to the moon compared with stretching some facets of law would be the easier part. That
We not only have to stretch the law, but more importantly, stretch the resources occasionally that we have. Because once you're committed to a certain program, you just have to keep going.
You know, talking of committedness, I am not following this, I suppose, sufficiently to know whether or not Russia is now in the race to the moon again or out of the race to the moon. It seemed to me that there was first she does, then she doesn't kind of thing.
Well, verbally, anyway.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I was a little confused myself for a while and then asked for a verbatim transcript of what Khrushchev really had said. And very much to my surprise, I found out that Khrushchev has never said at any time that he wasn't going to the moon. All he had said was that Russia wouldn't go to the moon before she was ready.
Well, now that's
I think
saying
nobody,
nothing.
Nobody in this country has ever made any different statements. We
mm-hmm.
won't go to the moon either before we are ready.
Well, then
it just wouldn't very well be possible, would it?
No, apparently.
That's the,
he just didn't commit himself to any definite deadline.
You had the feeling from newspaper headlines that he had said, we will not race you to the moon, but did not preclude the fact that someday we'll get there. But this really didn't appear in the, when you got to...
No, his statement, I read this verbatim statement, and it simply says, well, of course, we're interested in going to the moon, but there are dangers involved, and we will go about this thing in a systematic way, and we won't go there before we are ready.
I don't suppose there's a man alive who would read a statement like that with any more care and precision than you.
Yes, and that's the first time that I have heard an exact explanation of it. It just seemed to me before it was on again, off again, thin again kind
the
of thing.
The exact verbatim statement in the meantime has been run in several professional newspapers such as Aviation Week and missiles and rockets.
I'm glad you said aviation weeks and missiles. I rarely read aviation week and missiles and rockets.
You do?
I could have missed it.
You know, just touching back quickly to the law degree, though, I'm wondering, I'm reflecting, and I wish I could recall the gentleman's name, but it hasn't been over 2 or 3 weeks ago that a member of the law school of Yale University was with us, whose special field of interest is law in space, what there is of it. He made a most interesting statement at that time, and it was something along this line, that in general, agreements existed, and UN resolutions had been passed, which were being observed, not only for political reasons, but for just good common sense reasons, that would prompt him to say that there is really more effective law covering space right now than there is for the high seas on Earth. Would you come anyways near that assessment of it?
Well, I think in a way this is so. You see, the difficulty was defining reasonable and acceptable space law is the following. One concept would, of course, be to simply extend the air spaces into outer space and say, well, we all know what we mean with air superiority, which means flying through the air spaces above a country.
Mm-hmm.
And a country that insists on air superiority, on air sovereignty above its terrain means that we will not tolerate any foreign aircraft flying over our land. As you extend this concept into outer space, you get into a funny situation. The Earth rotates, mm-hmm. and there are other heavenly bodies up there. And for example, the moon may be for 10 minutes over the state of Ghana, only to move on over the area of some other African state, and you couldn't conceive of the moon changing hands every 10 minutes just because it passes over another country because of the rotation of the Earth. By the same token, the satellite going around the Earth in an hour and a half mm-hmm. crosses so many boundaries it would become absolutely meaningless to speak about space sovereignty in the sense of air sovereignty.
If John Glenn had to clear customs, he wouldn't be back down yet.
He wouldn't be back.
I thought of a popular song, Dr. Von Braun. I think that suddenly, that when it was written, I think it was written with only romantic intent, it suddenly becomes literally true in view of what you said. Its title was, "The Moon Belongs to Everyone." And the best things in life are free. That's right. It was
I think this is probably not only the best concept from the ethical point, but also the most practical concept, that we simply say space ought to be free like the seas, and the moon ought to be free like or Antarctica, say, where
yes.
several countries
mm-hmm.
have set up research operations, and there is a gentleman's agreement on interest areas of interest, shall we say,
even
in the sense that we will concentrate more on this or on that area, but the fundamental principle in space ought to be space is free.
Founders of new suburbs, I think, would agree, and I imagine you'll bear this out, that the moon is about as undesirable as Antarctica as a place to interest people in living or staying very long other than for some purpose. Would that be true?
Well, I think you should be a little careful with a sweeping statement of this nature. You see, we've learned a great deal in the last 50 years to build a very comfortable environment anywhere.
Mm.
For example, in a typical Polaris submarine, you have over 100 able-bodied young men cooped up for a quarter of a year,
mm-hmm.
these missions, and they live in air-conditioned comfort, and they don't even feel a temperature difference whether they're under the ice of the North Pole or on the tropic waters. Or when you board an airliner, you have your steak dinner at 35,000 feet in an environment where if your pressurization and air conditioning system would fail, and you wouldn't have some equipment such as oxygen mask or rapid descent to get you down into a safe area, you would die within a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no difficulty whatsoever to build a very hospitable environment on the moon today.
But the trouble is, you could never leave your immediate environment. Then.
Well, why would you?
Pardon me?
Why would you?
Oh, just to go see what's outside.
In view of the description we
well,
had.
On a summer day in Phoenix, Arizona, you don't go outside either, you see. And yet there are very profitable electronics companies working in the southwestern states. I doubt whether the majority of the people working there do much else but going out of the air-conditioned house and the air-conditioned automobile and then onto the air-conditioned office or laboratory and do the same thing the evening again. I think they really don't expose themselves very much to the murderous summer climate outside.
I shan't worry then about our expedition there, but there used to be an old song that mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the noonday sun in Rangoon, I think it was. So when the British get there, perhaps it'll be different.
But this does present a very, a very peculiar picture. If you were to go to the moon for any time, your environment being an enclosure of some kind, maybe even the vehicle that took you there, would have to be able to be mobile as long as you wanted to remain in the area. And, you'd hippity-hop instead of going out the door from your air-conditioned car to your, from your air-conditioned house to your air-conditioned car, you'd never leave it. It would have to move with you wherever you wanted to go.
No, you could very well go into a vehicle that is connected with an airlock to the living spaces so that you never break the airlock, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
This is entirely possible. You see, particularly with nuclear power available for electric mm-hmm. power generation, the problem of power generation is no longer a problem. To keep pumps and air conditioner and air conditioners and blowers and this kind of equipment running, even for months,
mm-hmm.
this is no longer a problem, and we can make these artificial environments just as comfortable, I would say more comfortable, than the world outside.
Dr. Von Braun, aside from scientific reasons and the necessity of exploring new fields all of the time, are there any particular strategic reasons or military reasons why going to the moon and being able to create an environment where you can move and work and live there would be important to a country?
Well, I think it is pretty obvious that outer space has a terrific military importance for from the point of view of our security on Earth. Vice President Johnson said the other day he couldn't understand how some people could live with the idea that we could be first on Earth without being first in space.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is really that simple. The Earth floats in space, and unless we have ways and means of really moving through space, if other people can do it, then our security down here would be very greatly endangered. Now, there is, of course, a question what forms may threats from outer space take,
mm-hmm.
and conversely, what countermeasures could we conceive to protect ourselves against such threats? Here we are up against the following very simple dilemma. There is a very small body of practical experience available at this time about manned flight in space. In fact, all we've logged so far is something like 60 hours space flight with our four orbiting astronauts. The Russians have logged maybe 120 or something.
Do you have a reasonable amount of information on theirs at all?
Yes. But the point I'm driving at is, on such a puny body of practical experience, you cannot even develop an intelligent concept on what military space weapon systems should be.
Mm-hmm.
I consider our situation comparable to the situation in aviation shortly after the Wright brothers invented the airplane. It was pretty obvious that this thing must have a terrific military significance. But when people went to the old artillery officer and asked him, well, what good is this Wright Brothers airplane for? Chances were he would have said, well, I can't imagine it is worth much because all equipment that's really useful in war weighs at least 10 tons, namely my...
Yes, how will I put a cannon on that
pieces
thing?
And how can it carry a cannon?
Mm-hmm.
And a cavalry officer probably couldn't have seen the thing too useful either because he couldn't come to grips with the enemy, with lances or some...
Well, and more recently, when the Joint Chiefs of Staff were fussing about who was more important and which would do which, if you remember, they all each thought his own field was the very most important, and there was certain duplication of experiment and certain duplication of weapons, and really, it's understandable why, prior to Pearl Harbor, when the Navy had been the main defense of the country, at least in the eyes of the Navy Department, and I have
first
seen and read it was our first line
of
defense, and after Pearl Harbor, I think probably dating from that and the Second World War, air defense came into its own. Now you're anticipating space defense.
Well, what I'm really saying is very much like in order to develop even the very first concepts of aerial warfare, such as the dogfight that dominated the scene in World War I, it was first necessary to expose a lot of people to aviation.
Mm-hmm.
And only by building up a core of flyers was it possible to develop practical concepts of military use of aviation. And I think very much in the same way, what we really need today is a huge body of practical space flight experience, and then let's go from there. Let's, for example, inspect one of the Russian satellites that's going around there with a manned vehicle just for a look-see, and then...
Pull it over to the curb as a traffic officer
does? Take a look at it and inspect it, and then maybe come up with some special equipment to find out what's inside without breaking it, because it may be a scientific thing after all, not a military satellite.
Uh-huh.
So I think rather than sitting here and arguing what forms space weaponry may take one fine day, we should develop the basic capabilities again.
Of performing. We're up against a break right now.
Yes, we'll pause quickly and be right back. We can pick up as we resume, just where we left off, if you like. I think you were about to say something, Dr. Lundgren.
We were just talking about the concept of the freedom of the seas versus the freedom of space. Now let's look at how navies developed in the world. I think this, is a good analogy. First of all, there was trade across the seas and the oceans. And then as a result of ships carrying cargo, some pirates came into the act to try to get a hold of that cargo. So in order to protect the trade ships from the pirates, navies were created.
Police, really, in that
To police the seaways, you might say, to keep them free, to assure free passage of the trade. This, I think, was basically the origin of all navies. Now, in space, we may have a very similar situation as we are setting up communication satellites and weather satellites and all kinds of satellites, maybe one fine day snooper type satellites, observation satellites, the other guy may not like it, and so the question is, he may want to put them out of commission, which in turn puts you in a position that you want to protect them, and of all this concepts may develop one day.
Hmm. You make it sound comfortably distant anyway, the time when that might come to pass.
Well, now, let us not forget, on the other hand, that intercontinental ballistic missiles are traveling through space right now.
Yes.
Which is maybe the best proof that space has a military significance.
I think that was the shortest live apathy I ever enjoyed.
It wasn't really so apathetic. It was just kind of a comfortable sigh of relief.
One does forget that, though, the ICBM. And that goes into the whole realm of the, doesn't it, of the anti-missile missile and who has it and who doesn't and all the rest. And
There are many people who believe that the anti-missile missile, while technically feasible, is probably an operational impossibility, but that a defense system against ballistic long-range missiles can be developed at a space located.
Would you give me that again? Mm-hmm. But what?
Well, that we have a defense system, or develop in the defense system
mm-hmm.
against ICBMs that is physically located in space. In other words, that takes on missiles that come out of the atmosphere
mm-hmm.
and intercept them before they go back in.
Dr. Van Braun, I wonder what it was that I read in passing, something, it was an announcement from Russia, I believe, that they had either succeeded in developing an anti-missile missile, or they had in some way perfected a system of defense. There was an enormous range, as I remember the announcement.
Well, I think what you're referring to was that the Russians actually carted a rocket, explained to their own people as an anti-missile missile, through the streets of Moscow in one of their recent political
yes.
rallies. And many people wonder, does this now mean that they have an effective anti-missile against our deterrent weapons? Well, I think the answer to this is the following. We too have an anti-missile missile that has been demonstrated in operation repeatedly. That's the Nike Zeus.
Mm-hmm.
For example, it has shot down an Atlas rocket fired over from Vandenberg Air Force Base, California, into the Kwajalein area, and it has intercepted the thing. But there is a tremendous difference between a demonstration of the technical feasibility of such a thing, which we have done, and which presumably the Russians also have done, and the introduction of an anti-missile system that really gives you an adequate protection for the United States.
There was always the problem of decoys, too, wasn't there?
There's the problem of decoys. You can expel decoys so that instead of an ICBM, a whole cloud of ICBMs seems to be coming your way, and you have to discriminate which one is the thing.
Because you only have so many...
You get a lot of pips on your radar, a whole cloud full. Some are decoys, and one out of that cloud of decoys is the real thing, and now... have to discriminate within the short time available which is the thing. Which one do we have
problem.
To intercept? But another equally important and critical thing is the cost aspect. For example, it has been estimated that to provide an anti-missile defense system for a major object, say like Greater New York City or Chicago or the Los Angeles area, that this would cost something like $5 billion. Just for this one area. Now, if you identify, say, 20 of the key areas in the United States that you want to furnish this kind of a defense system, you spend $100 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, you have no assurance whether out of 10 hydrogen-tipped Russian ICBMs, you may possibly intercept 9 and one still comes through, and one is enough to knock out the whole city. So it's not really an airtight system.
Mm-hmm.
And the dilemma the defense planners are in a nutshell, is shall we really spend $100 billion on this kind of a concept that doesn't give us an airtight umbrella against Russian ICBMs, mm-hmm. but only a limited degree of protection, or should we spend $100 billion on something else that may be a more effective means of preventing the Russians from firing at us in the first place?
You know,
I think I'd go
about,
with that.
About time for another of our quick pauses. But I was just thinking of the, there has to be always, when money is spent, an attendant political problem, which goes away from your precise realm, Dr. Von Braun, but I would hate to be the politician who ultimately had to verify the defense order that these 20 cities get the treatment and the rest don't, you know? I have a feeling the mail count and the polls would not go well for you. We'll pause quickly for just a touch of the weather and news and right back to the second half of this conversation with Dr. Werner Von Braun.
Absolutely.
Now then, we're back again, and we're ready for the second half of our conversation with Dr. Werner von Braun. I guess we'd wound up the phase we were in just a minute ago.
Mm-hmm. The decision where to spend the money on defense of 20 key cities, or to invest it rather into the kind of defense that would prevent an enemy from ever firing a shot.
Then the question comes up, and the one that was discussed here on our own station some time back by the listeners in one of the programs in which a newsman moderates and callers call in, of the value for the money expended, the value to be had in exploration of the moon as related to what might be done with it otherwise, say in defense, or I gathered from a few of the listeners, just in putting it in the bank and paying some on the national debt.
Well, speaking of money investment, the other day I attended a hearing in a congressional subcommittee where I had been invited to testify, and one of the leading researchers in this country said that he could probably prove that there was an average of 20% return on the dollar invested in research in this country. When you just look at the totality of money spent on research against the totality of returns that had come out of these things directly or indirectly in consumer products and so forth. So this is probably one of the best investments that have ever been invented.
Yeah, if we were to put that in miniature, we might say that had any one of us, not knowing aeronautics, not knowing anything except that a couple of boys in Indiana, wasn't it, had an idea they could build a thing that would fly, and they wanted the money from us to do it, I'm afraid I wouldn't have been an investor in a hurry. Now, we have so much more
Ohio
to go on. Ohio,
was
Kitty Hawk, Ohio.
No, Kitty Hawk was North Carolina, but the boys came from Dayton, Ohio.
Dayton,
the
Ohio.
Wright brother.
Well, I'm very pleased to straighten that out. our signal does not always go that far east, but it would be just my luck that this would be a day when it bounced over there and we'd get a lot of adverse mail.
But that does leave the first part of the question.
Well, to answer your question, why do we have to go to the moon?
Mm-hmm.
Let me put it this way. The president put it very well when he said we have to learn to sail on that new ocean of space.
Wow.
This is really the important thing. For exploratory, for military, for scientific, for all kinds of reasons. But now the question is this. Space all by itself is not a program and not an objective. If it is a place with three dimensions and all three leading to infinity. So you cannot define a space program by simply saying, let's go out there and sail the ocean. This is like establishing a Navy program, let's sail the other ocean. You have to establish a more immediate objective. And realizing this, the president has said, we have to find an objective that everybody can clearly understand. And he selected very wisely, I think, the moon. Everybody knows what the moon is. And then he said, let's land a man on the moon in this decade and bring him back alive. Everybody knows what this decade is. Everybody knows, can tell an astronaut who returned from the moon to tell the story. So here is a clear objective that is universally understood. And it enables us, engineers and scientists, to convert the rather vague notion of a space exploration program into a hard-hitting industrial program. We can now go out and make a schedule and make plans for the research and the development and the manufacture and the testing of these parts, and we can price it out and go back to the Congress and say, here's our plan, and this is the kind of resources we need for 1964, 65, 66, 67, etc. And if you are willing to support what the president suggested, we can make it a go. And this has a tremendous advantage that it kind of locks us into a clear-cut objective to which we commit ourselves, and we know it is, shall we say, like buying an automobile. It may come a little hard to make the decision, can I afford the car? But once you make the decision, those monthly payments come with relentless regularity, and you know exactly that you have to pay.
Yes.
And I think from the point of view of keeping this program steadily supported, such a clear objective was absolutely necessary. Otherwise, the program would be subjected to the winds all the time. You just can't turn a thing like this on and off like a water tap.
No, and people would get tired of hearing about it, and it would be old, that old dream.
Well, but you see, I see this very clearly in my own work. Here we spend maybe $100 million on fabulous test facilities in fiscal year 1963. If in 1964 you do not find the funds to mend this facility, then you had no business building the facility to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
These are long-range projects that require a sustained level of support, and we cannot stand this hot and cold blowing that so very easily results on unless you have a clear long-range objective.
You know, it's so hard to conceive, too, of the complexity of a situation. For example, you mentioned in passing there a minute ago the creation of equipment, of parts, of things that will be needed. You have to anticipate that which doesn't exist, order the real physical entities, and maybe later in research you may have to change this, that, or the other. I can't conceive of the complexity of
it. It is undoubtedly a very complex thing. On the other hand, you may have heard the figure that it has been estimated that $20 billion would be necessary to land a man on the moon. Well, the important message really is we do not spend $20 billion to go to the moon and pick up a handful of lunar sand.
Yes.
This would really be a stunt. But about 19 of those $20 billion are spent to develop the big rockets and the test stand and develop the industrial complex and the launch facilities and all these things. And they produce what I said at the beginning, a manned spaceflight capability per se. And only $1 billion out of those 20 maybe is spent very specifically for the landing on the moon.
What's
for example, that? The big Saturn V rocket that we are building at Marshall with the help of industry, that will give the expedition the first initial push, can throw a Boeing 707 or the weight equivalent of a Boeing 707 into orbit around the Earth. And this rocket really doesn't care what that payload is, whether it's a lunar expedition to go onto the moon, or whether you want to build a big space station in a low Earth orbit, or whether one fine day somebody knows of a military gadget that weighs that much and he wants to bring up there. I think we have learned one thing, that the key to a real space capability is cargo carrying capability into orbit. We need
That's
big
right.
rockets.
You're 20. And billion, in other words, means not one man, but for the future,
it's
all men who need to go for any cause.
The entire space capability per se is being developed with it, and the moon is just the focusing point. The president could have said, let's build a space station
yes.
for that money, or something else, but it was absolutely necessary to establish a clear objective that you could use as the catalyst or the focusing point for the program.
That's a much bigger idea.
That we have a baseline for the thing.
It's a much bigger idea, isn't it, really, to learn... How was it he said? Let us learn to sail...
Sail on the ocean.
The ocean of space.
Let us learn to sail on the ocean.
Because ultimately that includes it all, in the space platform and it all.
And I think if we don't learn to sail on that ocean, we can really be in very serious trouble, even if today we are not in a position to clearly define what forms a threat from outer space posed by the Russian one they may take.
Well, we are more...
And speaking of serious trouble...
Yes, we do have a break. I was just going to say, we are at least in that exploration more favorably inclined as human beings than we were when, not so terribly long ago in time, someone had to get a queen to sell her jewels just to prove that the world wasn't flat. There are enough people, I think, who really believe this and in this. Now let us pause and come right back. Dr. Von Braun, I expect that if they knew you were around in any given town or hamlet in America, you would be followed by a trail of small boys, as many small boys as are in that town, and you must get scads of mail that someone has to answer and that sort of thing. include mine amongst them, but it caused me thinking about that just now to say to myself, I wonder if you, as a boy, were ever dreaming of this, what it was that, say, as a young boy in late grammar school, maybe, was the way you were beginning to think, or did you have something totally different in mind? Did you think you would be the man who was going to be thinking about going to the moon someday?
Well, my interest in rocketry actually originated with an interest in astronomy. When I was a boy, my parents gave me a telescope, and I used to look at the moon and the stars, and I happened to run in a book one day where a professor explained in terms rather incomprehensible to me at the time that one could travel to the moon, and I thought this was a very fascinating thing. When I was out of school, I joined a society of space flight enthusiasts, and we started tinkering with little rockets.
How were you regarded? By your fellow citizens in general?
Well, most people thought we were nuts, and we thought all the others were nuts, so they didn't see it. But out of these humble beginnings developed, what we now, of course, consider a very limited capability to demonstrate at least the feasibility of some of these liquid fuel rockets. And then the military got interested and started supporting this, again, at the beginning with rather moderate funds.
Mm-hmm.
As you all know, rocketry, not only in Germany at that time, but in other countries too, got the first funding from the military by and large, just like in aviation.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it is only now that the rocket has really, the big rocket has come on its own in the sense that it can pay for itself in non-military applications, just like the airplane again.
Yes, we've heard references, and this is another point I wanted to ask you about. We've heard references, for example, to the idea that there will be a day when we will fly the mail from New York to Los Angeles in the twinkling of an eye by rocket. But this brings us around to popular journalism and its concepts as it conveys them to the very people who have to support these programs. It brings us around to science fiction. I'm wondering these two things. The journalist looking for what is spectacular and reportable and understandable in a complex field, and the science fictionaire looking for that which is, of that kind of, that brand of literature. Have these people ultimately helped the cause?
Yes, very much so. I think a lot of good ideas that are presently being used in practical hardware came out of science fiction suggestions. Mm-hmm. Of course, the science fiction author has the great advantage that he doesn't have to produce some hardware.
Yes.
That really does what he says it can do.
Just
so he can just be completely uninhibited.
That's true, he doesn't have to prove it.
Which is where big ideas come from.
Nine out of ten proposals of science fiction are probably the kind that couldn't stand the light of day if they had to be converted into hardware, but every now and then there's a diamond among these ideas that, for example, I remember many, many years ago, I read a science fiction novel where an astronaut returning from a planet found that he was not coming in on the right approach path, and he asked the Earth to send him a computer instruction for his tape recorder to put him back in the right groove, you see.
Okay.
Now, I thought at the time, by God, this sounds a pretty good idea. It's maybe a little on the fantastic side. All I'm telling you, that's precisely what we're doing now.
Yes.
I wonder if you didn't put that down in your notebook at the time, but
you certainly
kept it in mind.
We are using these very techniques now.
And you remember the story after all this time, which certainly settles mm-hmm. the question of impact.
Well, of course, the inventive act by this one author alone didn't do the trick. It was the development of electronic digital computer techniques and so forth that, along with this idea, makes these new techniques possible.
Now let us pause and come right back.
You know, you spoke of the time when you were just with a very small group and you were talking about flight in outer space, and everybody else thought you were all kind of nuts. Well, we've moved from that time, and I think at the time you were in Germany, to the point where such scientists as yourself, instead of being thought to be slightly loony, were tenderly cherished. And so it was interesting to me. I knew, of course, that you yourself had decided to come to the West at one particular point. But I was very startled to read that you had led a group of 100. Now, even considering the fact that scientists were cherished, I would guess they were also pretty closely protected. And although it might be a personal question and one that you'd prefer not to answer, I can't help but think that to admit to 100 other people your own idea about going over to the other side would have been a most dangerous situation for you personally.
Well, you see, the situation was this. Towards the end of the war, when things crumbled on German fronts from all sides, we were at our Peenemünde experimental station on the Baltic, and when the Russian army was about 50 miles away, we could do two things: either stay and wait for them to move in with their tanks, or move out.
Mm-hmm.
And there was so much confusion at the time that we had all kinds of different directives, whether we should stay and or whether we should move, that we could really pick the order that suited us best, and that happened to be the order to move. We had a degree of protection, but this also was only a degree, because you could have been shot just for following the wrong order. Things were a little confused at that time. Well, the important motivation, not only on my own part, but my associates and all of us at the time, can best be explained as follows. We knew that we had pioneered a new technology, and that we probably were way ahead in this particular field of building guided large rockets. We also knew all along that the thing would have a tremendous military capability, and B, a tremendous capability in the space exploration field. So our feeling towards this new technology was like that of, shall we say, parents who have a little child. They know that they are in difficulties continuing to support this child, and they wanted to put the child in the proper hands of some foster parents that would give this child the necessary protection. At the same time, of course, just like parents, you wanted to make sure that they wouldn't abuse the child. And in other words, you were looking for to whom would I have the confidence
and
trust my child.
Mighty hard.
This was essentially our motivation. Now, my older brother was an exchange student here in America, and he had told me a great deal about America, so I knew pretty well what I expect from all his the many evenings spent with him on the subject, and for me there was absolutely no choice. America was a place to go. In fact, I'd even played with the idea long before the war to come to America, so it was in a way a fulfillment of a delayed dream, you might say.
You know, and we're almost at the end. I can't resist asking a question. Dr. von Braun, we mentioned science fiction a minute ago, and the fact that it did at least caused some wild brainstorming, some of which has been very well borne out. But now today, here you are, your mind must be turned to this problem constantly. I'm just curious, when you now turn for any kind of recreational reading, if you can, what do you turn to today? I can't feature you reading science fiction today.
No, very little today.
No change.
I love to listen to music, and I read books on all kinds of subjects in science, and every now and then, for example, right now I'm reading a book on Greek history.
Oh, really? That somehow I just had that feeling that this would be the case, and the science fiction writers, I don't think, would be too disillusioned there, because you've said something that...
Well, they can't really keep up with us anymore. That's their
they can't,
problem.
As a matter of
beat them at their own game.
They can't, as a
sometimes you wonder if we could only tell them how we are doing this.
Give them a few new ideas. Our guest today on WDAF Conversation, and this has been a signal day for Signal Hill, has been Dr. Werner von Braun, who is director of NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center, which is in Redstone. We're very happy to have had you. This is Jean Glenn for Walt Bodine saying goodbye.
Thank you.